Good afternoon, may it please the court. My name is Dean Neuwirth. With co-counsel Kianya O'Connell, we represent the appellant Jason Reynolds. I'd like to focus on the first argument in our briefs, the intervening cause argument. And within that argument, I'd like to talk in particular about the participation element in Colorado law. Specifically, I'd like to try and show you that there was a jury question in this case whether the defendant's initial participation had ended, and that question should have been allowed to go to the jury for the jury to decide rather than been decided as a matter of law by the trial court. To try and make that showing to you, I'm going to do something I don't normally do in an oral argument, which is talk some more about the facts. We discussed in our briefs that there was a key eyewitness named Mr. Kimsey who was trailing the cars that got into the accident. Excuse me. He testified at trial that the Forerunner followed the Jeep for about 10 seconds before it went into the left lane. What we didn't include in our briefs, but which is also in the trial record, is that there was evidence at trial that during the preliminary hearing, Mr. Kimsey made the same testimony about the 10-second period of gap of time, and that even said it could have been longer. And that citation is volume 8, pages 84 to 85, at the January 23rd tab. After Mr. Kimsey made this testimony, the district attorney and the district attorney's expert separately told, in one instance, the court, and the other, the jury, that the 10 seconds was an important fact. It was important in understanding how this accident could have occurred. Those citations for the district attorney, volume 7, pages 192 to 194, January 19th tab, for the prosecution's expert, volume 8, 86 to 87, January 22nd tab. Importantly, at the close of the case, during closing arguments, the district attorney counted 10 seconds to the jury. If you look at volume 8, page 82, January 24th tab, the district attorney says 1, 2, 3, etc., up till 10, and then the district attorney says to the jury, that's a long time. Our position is that if 10 seconds was a long time for the district attorney, then it might have been a long time for the jury too. And the jury should have been given an instruction that if they found that under the evidence, the 10 seconds was, well, not the 10 seconds, but if they found under the evidence that the defendant's initial participation had ended, then they could find an intervening cause. And our position is the jury should have been given that chance. I'd like to turn
to... Pardon me for interrupting you, Mr.
Yes, Judge Bernard.
Please. You say that 10 seconds may be sufficient time for a jury to conclude that the defendant's participation had ended, thus allowing the victim's conduct to be an intervening cause. Do you have any cases that support time as little as 10 seconds?
Judge, I don't have any cases in this area at all. I looked, spent a lot of time looking at the law of other jurisdictions. I don't even find the participation element to be the law in other jurisdictions. We cited in our case the Munoz case the Munoz case out of Connecticut, the Malone case out of Alaska, the Schaefer case out of Michigan. I found another case preparing for argument out of the state of Washington. They all just talk about foreseeability. They say a superseding or intervening cause can occur if the victim's response is abnormal human behavior and therefore gives rise to gross negligence. So there's nothing in Colorado. I would analogize to other areas of the law where the defendant commits an initial act, but the law recognizes that a subsequent change in the defendant's behavior can affect the defendant's criminal liability. Three examples that come to mind are you can be a member of a conspiracy and then withdraw from the conspiracy later. You can commit a criminal solicitation and then subsequently renounce the solicitation.
Mr. Neuwirth, let me interrupt you. So the intervening cause, though throughout the case, you're arguing is the swerving of the forerunner. Is it something else other than the swerving or the movement of the forerunner into the left lane?
It's that, Your Honor, followed by the forerunner contacting the Jeep side by side. It's those two events as a series.
Okay, so why does the 10 seconds matter? I mean, the evidence is the forerunner moved from behind the Jeep to the left lane. There is a disputed fact as to whether it intentionally rammed the Jeep or accidentally overcorrected to hit the Jeep.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why does the 10 seconds matter at all?
I'm making what I would consider to be a worst-case scenario from my client's point of view. In our briefs, we did take the position that it does not matter, that the evidence was the evidence, it was disputed, it should have gone to the jury for the jury to resolve the dispute. What I'm doing now is saying that if you take Stewart and you read it about as broadly as I think it can be read, but you go back and look at the evidence to see if there's a way of distinguishing this case from Stewart, I think the 10 seconds does it. Because if you look at the facts of the Stewart case, there was a continuity of interaction between the defendant and the victim. The case says that the defendant is driving through a parking lot. He encounters the victim as a pedestrian. He drives so close to the victim that he brushes him. A verbal altercation immediately ensues. The defendant begins to drive, I think the opinion says, back and forth and in an aggressive manner. And in one of those transitions or movements, that's where the victim is fatally injured. So what I'm saying is you can distinguish this case from that case, and this case should have gone to the jury on the issue of intervening cause because we have the 10 seconds. And the defendant could have disengaged. The jury could have viewed it that way.
Is the argument that you're making now, was that made specifically in the trial court or in your briefs on appeal?
We made it on page 14 of the reply brief in response to an argument that Mr. Yazdi made. And the facts on which we relied were raised in the opening brief. In terms of the trial court, the 10 seconds was litigated very extensively. And in fact, the trial court, it was raised because the trial court dispensed with it when the trial court rejected the defendant's effort to have the intervening cause instruction given. And that occurred on volume 8, pages 33 to 34, January 24th, tab. What happened there was, in ruling on the defendant's request for an intervening cause instruction, the trial court said, it doesn't matter that Mr. Kimsey testified that the forerunner followed the Jeep for 10 seconds, because Mr. Kimsey also testified that when the forerunner did move left, it swerved in what appeared to be an avoidance maneuver rather than a purposeful lane change. So the 10 seconds was addressed. Our contention is that the dispute in the evidence, the purpose for which the forerunner moved, is a jury question. That's for the jury to resolve. The jury either decides, yes, the forerunner was reacting, had no choice, or because of the 10 seconds, there was a thought period and the forerunner's driver made a conscious decision. It's not a question for the court to resolve as a matter of law.
So in that case then, it would be your position that, as a matter of law, had the forerunner driver become angry, decided to move to the left lane and ram the Jeep, that would be an intervening cause?
No, not as a matter of law, Your Honor. It goes to the jury either way.
That the jury would decide whether it was an intervening cause.
Yes.
And that the judge could not decide that still, as gross negligence, it would not interrupt the flow of events.
Well, the judge agreed that if it happened that way, it would have constituted gross negligence, But then the judge, yes, should not have decided that even if it happened that way, it could not have interrupted the flow of events. That's a jury question.
Okay.
And to try and bring that point home, I'll raise one other illustration, that the trial court, in denying the request for an intervening cause instruction, also said it doesn't matter whether Mr. Reynolds braked accidentally or on purpose, because he created a situation to which the 4Runner's driver had to react. That's the but-for causation that was discussed in our briefs. But that kind of begs the question of, well, how do you react? There, if you as a driver respond in kind, then the situation escalates to increase the risk of harm to other drivers caused by the initial act, that there's a choice in how one responds. The 404B drivers in this case did not respond in a road rage manner. And I would suggest to the court that the rationale of the trial court actually could lead to a bad policy result of encouraging road rage responses to initial behavior, whether the initial behavior by the first driver is merely careless and is perceived as intentional by another driver, or is itself intentional and the other driver says, I'm not going to put up with that. Either way, it's not a policy that ought to be promoted.
I would think, though, that in this case, anyone who might be motivated to take that kind of vengeance would realize that in this case, the person who arguably did that died. I mean, it seems to me one would not be terribly well motivated based on the actions of assumed actions, alleged actions of someone who was killed.
That's true in this case, Your Honor, but I could envision situations where the second escalator might not die and might walk away unscathed, and the only person who might be hurt is a third party.
Okay.
I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right, Mr. Neuwirth, you have, according to our clock, 2 minutes and 51 seconds.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Your Honor. My name is Majid Yazdi, registration 36043, representing the people in this case. Because there is quite extensive discussion on the 10 seconds issue in the brief, and Mr. Neuwirth started his argument based presenting that as an important issue, I'd like to quickly point out that the 10 seconds, first of all, does not refer to the 4Runner following the Jeep for 10 seconds. The 10 seconds actually is the amount of time from the time that Mr. Norman was distracted looking at his cell phone and was able to look back on
Mr.
the road.
Mr. Kimsey or Mr. Norman?
I'm sorry, Mr. Kimsey was distracted from the road and briefly looked at the cell phone, and then by the time that he looked back on the road and saw Mr. Norman behind the defendant, and the first thing that he saw at that time was swerving to the left. So there was no 10 seconds driving on the same lane behind the Jeep. Secondly, the 10 seconds is absolutely irrelevant to the issue before this court regarding the intervening cause. As the court noted, Mr. Neuwirth's argument is somewhat different from what was presented in the opening brief, and actually what the court, the issue before the court. The intervening cause that the court had to decide on and ruled against the defendant for defendant's request for an intervening cause instruction had to do with the ramming issue. The 10 second was not part of the argument in support of intervening cause. However, even if that is an issue that the court is interested in considering, the 10 seconds simply shows that there was a gap between the action by the defendant, which is decelerating and actually slamming on the brake. And the argument is that Mr. Norman had enough time to disengage. However, what happened at that point is simply Mr. Norman swerving to the left. And no one has argued that Mr. Norman's swerving to the left is gross negligence. And that is what would require, what is required in order to an intervening cause exist. So even if we assume that for whatever, for the 10 seconds or whatever time period allowed Mr. Norman to disengage himself, and then the action that is supposedly the intervening cause here is the swerving to the left, that by definition does not qualify, because there is no argument, and there it was not below argued that the mere fact of swerving to the left, whether it was controlled or forced, it constituted gross negligence. Now, on the question of the ramming of the Jeep, the only evidence that we have of this to address the issue that the court addressed is the defendant's, Mr. Reynolds, out-of-court statement, which is, as I suggested, it lacks credibility because it is absolutely self-serving. It is speculative.
Pardon me, though, Mr. Yazdi. Isn't it the case that those statements were introduced by the prosecution?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if so, wasn't the jury entitled to consider them and make up their own minds whether they bought what the defendant said to the police in those statements or not?
Your Honor, there's no question that the threshold issue before the court was whether the statement was credible enough, because the basic requirement is some credible evidence for giving the instruction. So it is true that the statement was introduced. However, that does not affect whether the statement qualified under some credible evidence.
Well, ultimately, since it was before the jury, wasn't that really for them to resolve in that context? And the reason I say that is People versus Cunningham, the case upon which you rely principally, was a case about not introducing it at all. And the reason that it wasn't introduced at all was because it was self-serving hearsay. But in this case, it was offered by the prosecution, so it's part of the package the jury gets to look at. And I'm wondering how far your argument really goes that the court shouldn't have considered this once the prosecution had put it on the table.
Your Honor, this is only part of the analysis that the court did, that the statement was not credible, because the court looked at the total evidence presented, and not only the statement was out of court statement hearsay and speculative, because there was no way for Mr. Reynolds to know the state of mind of defendant, Mr. Norman, whether it was intentional or because he was out of control. The two expert witnesses, defense expert witnesses, both rejected that idea that there was any intentional ramming involved, because they said from the moment that Mr. Norman swerved to the left, he lost control.
Mr. Yazdi, what you're arguing is which witness should be believed. I mean, Mr. Reynolds' statement said that Mr. Norman pulled alongside and made an obscene gesture. I mean, that's the evidence. Now, what one infers from that evidence is up for the jury, it would seem. Now, you're suggesting that, well, because the experts disagreed, then somehow or another we ought to decide what weight to give it.
Your Honor, what I would like to emphasize is that although this statement was admitted, the credibility of this statement still, as a threshold issue before the court, was to determine if there was some credible evidence. And what I was presenting is the total analysis that the court did to determine whether there was some credible evidence or not.
But even if you're right about that, I mean, did the judge here then instruct the jury that it was to disregard that particular statement that the defendant made? Because otherwise it's sitting in front of the jury and they don't know what to do with it.
No, because the statement had been introduced. Of course, it was before the jury in terms of understanding the total factual situation. So I don't think the court was required to ask the jury to disregard this statement. And in fact, there was discussion about whether proximate cause, in the context of discussing whether the prosecution had proved proximate cause, the prosecution addressed that issue and explained that that could not have happened. So that statement, and whether it was credible or not, was before the jury in terms of proximate causation issue. What I'm suggesting is that because for the jury to be instructed specifically on the intervening cause, the court had to make a determination whether there was some credible evidence or not, then it was right for the court to look at the evidence and consider it as lacking credibility. But moreover, the court did not rely only on that. The court addressed also the question of participation and stated that assuming that the foreseeability issue is resolved in favor of the defendant, which is itself questionable because the action induced and incited by the defendant cannot completely be unforeseeable. Whatever Mr. Norman did was within seconds of what happened to him because of the defendant. So that kind of response cannot be completely unforeseeable. But more important, the court said that because of the participation, and on this issue, I think Stewart is dispositive of this case, because the Stewart court specifically said, as an independent factor, by the way, because Ms. Neuwirth suggests that we should limit participation to foreseeability, and Stewart rejects that. Stewart and cases before that all argue that there are two factors involved here, foreseeability and non-participation. So if we limit the issue of non-participation to foreseeability, then that becomes redundant. All we have to do is to look at foreseeability, and if it's unforeseeable, then we say it is an intervening cause. The Stewart court did not do that. It looked at whether it was intervening cause in terms of the time of the action, and then considered whether the defendant had participated or not. And because the defendant had participated, the court said that also disqualifies defendant from being entitled to an intervening instruction.
Would that argument eliminate then the foreseeability issue entirely? I mean, if there is participation, it would seem, then if I understand your argument correctly, whether the following action is foreseeable or unforeseeable, the actor is still liable.
I'm not suggesting an absolutely unlimited liability as long as participation exists, but definitely participation itself is a factor here. Now, we can imagine situations where the consequence, the reaction by the victim is completely unforeseeable. If here, for example, the victim had responded by exploding a bomb later on in retaliation, that might be a factor here, but we don't have the kind of situation that poses even a borderline of foreseeability. The timing here, the location here, and the action in response to the defendant, it wasn't targeted at someone else, it was targeted at the defendant. So all of those factors, when we take into account, they suggest that there is sufficient causal connection between that act and defendant's behavior. And to that extent, participation should preclude defendant from being entitled to an intervening cause instruction.
I have another question about the participation issue. How does participation here differ from the very act, the criminal act itself that's being alleged? I mean, isn't that on its face participation? And if that's the case, isn't there a redundancy there?
The typical case of an independent intervening cause is, for example, when medical providers provide improper or negligent care, which has nothing to do with the defendant. So in those cases, there is a clear distinction between the act committed by the defendant and an independent action committed by medical providers. So in those cases, there's an obvious distinction. But when the action of the defendant causes a particular response of the victim, then to that extent, we can't say that it is an independent action because it is a reaction to exactly what was done by the defendant. So to that extent, I would argue that it is not an independent factor, and participation induced that action and incited whatever reaction the victim committed.
Mr. Yazdi, I want to ask about Mr. Neuwirth's argument that this 10 seconds created an issue of fact. I understand your position on the 10 seconds, and so I'm going to talk a little bit hypothetically. Would you say that participation would exist if 24 hours after being cut off, a driver seeing the same driver who cut him off on the highway slams into him? Would that be participation, or would that be an intervening cause?
That's exactly the reason I mentioned, Your Honor, that in considering the sufficient causal connection, we look at the timing of the reaction, the location, if it happened at this time, or for example, we can even hypothesize that the victim goes to the defendant's house and retaliates somehow. Mm-hmm. Of course, in some way it is connected, but not sufficiently causally connected. So I would definitely take the timing factor into consideration.
All right,
the location.
If that's the case, is it a question of fact in this case that the jury should have been able to address?
Again, Your Honor, the 10 seconds was not presented even in connection with the intervening cause.
Assume it had been.
I would argue that under participation, we still have the issue of the court deciding whether there is sufficient participation to disqualify the defendant from to preclude the requirement of intervening cause, because that time, the 10 seconds, for example, it shows the degree of closeness of defendant's participation in the reaction by the victim. So it is still an issue before the court to make as a threshold decision. I see my time is up. Unless the court has any questions, I ask the court to affirm Mr. Reynolds' conviction.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Short one, yes, sir. I do have a question, Mr. Neuwirth, if I may, please. Thank you, sir. I'm sorry to call you back.
That's what I'm here for, Your Honor. Yeah.
I'd appreciate a response from your perspective to Mr. Yazdi's argument that the 10 seconds didn't apply.
I don't see how it could not have applied. I mean, it was evidence in the case. It came in repeatedly through different witnesses. Mr. Kimsey testified about it initially, and the courts will look at the record. I have a different recollection, and my record notes are different than Mr. Yazdi's recollection. I believe Mr. Kimsey was pretty clear that he saw 10 seconds where the forerunner was following the Jeep. But putting that point aside, it came in through Mr. Kimsey, it came in through State Trooper Pickering, who was the expert for the prosecution. Both of the defense experts were asked about the 10 seconds and testified about it. Both sides mentioned it in closing. As I said, the trial court referred to it in the ruling on the intervening cause instruction. And all along the way, the acknowledgments were, this is an important fact. Well, if it's an important fact in the case, it's an important fact for any conceivable use to which the jury might have given it. And that would include determining participation if the jury had been instructed in that fashion. And the defense did tender to the trial court intervening cause instructions that included participation. So if those instructions had been given, the jury would have had an opportunity to look at all the evidence, including the 10 seconds, to decide, was there still participation going on if we, the jurors, believe that the 10 seconds had elapsed the way Mr. Kimsey testified in court it did.
Thank you.
Mr. Neuwirth, when you began your argument, I got the impression that you were saying that this concept of participation is unique to Colorado, and that you were suggesting that we should not give it much credence. Was I mistaken?
Your Honor, I'm frankly confused by the law on this. Where Judge Loeb came out, how is this different from foreseeability? That's where I was on the briefs. When I sat down and prepared for oral argument, I looked at Stewart, I looked at the Liz Lahman case. It seems pretty clear that the Supreme Court believes there's participation. They just haven't articulated its scope yet. It wasn't at issue really in Stewart or in Lahman at all. And that's why I took the approach I did here. So I'm not poo-pooing it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. We'd ask the court to reverse and remand for retrial.
Thank you, counsel. The oral arguments in People